Oof, VOA won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Jill Robbins, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Many countries hard hit by the coronavirus are easing their strict and often unpopular measures to fight COVID-19. Nightclubs and movie theaters are reopening. People are no longer wearing face coverings or masks in public, especially in Europe and North America. Slowly, many countries are easing their COVID-19 restrictions, as officials hope the Omicron wave has passed its peak. The highly contagious Omicron variant has resulted in at least 90 million cases worldwide over the past 10 weeks. That is more than all cases in 2020, the pandemic's first year. But the World Health Organization, or WHO, this week said some countries can now consider easing the rules. They can do so if they have high vaccination rates, their healthcare systems are strong, and cases are not trending in the wrong direction. Restrictions are being lifted in many European countries, for many months the world's center of the pandemic. Restrictions are being lifted in South Africa, where Omicron was first announced publicly, and the United States. In Britain and the U.S., like South Africa before them, Omicron cases greatly increased at first, but are now coming down quickly. In the U.S., local leaders have had many different responses. The city of Denver announced plans to end its mask rules for businesses and public spaces, while keeping them for schools and public transportation. A move to ease a mask mandate in New York State, where cases have fallen, is in the courts. England, France, Ireland, the Netherlands, and several Nordic countries have taken steps to end or ease their restrictions. In some places, like Norway and Denmark, the easing comes even though case counts are still near their highs. Some governments are simply hoping that the pandemic is slowing. Last week, England ended almost all restrictions. Masks are not required in public, and vaccines are no longer needed to get into public spaces. The work-from-home order has also been lifted. However, those who test positive still have to isolate. On Tuesday, Norway lifted its ban on serving alcohol after 11 p.m., and the limit on private gatherings of no more than 10 people. Now it's time for us to take back our everyday life, Norway's health minister said Tuesday. More than 370 million cases and over 5.6 million deaths linked to COVID-19 have been reported worldwide. But the spread of the Omicron variant is beginning to slow in many places. It is giving rise to the hope that the pandemic is about to enter a new stage in which the virus, like the flu, is endemic but manageable. Omicron has shown to be less likely to cause severe illness than the Delta variant, but experts are still warning about the possibility of a new, more dangerous variant. I'm Dan Novak.
With the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing, the ruling Communist Party hopes to popularize winter sports as exercise and to make money. The games will take place from February 4th to the 20th. Many people in Beijing enjoy the winter sport of ice skating. But winter sports are new to most Chinese people. Now, young Chinese are considering winter sports like hockey and skiing. The government and some companies have built new structures for winter sports in many places. Public schools are adding winter sports. And villages near mountains where skiing is possible are building hotels and services for visitors. Mark Dreyer wrote the book Sporting Superpower, An Insider's View on China's Quest to Be the Best. Dreyer said, the effort to hold the Winter Olympics has pushed the development of winter sports. We've also seen a more organic push from China's middle class, recognizing the value of sports not just for their children, but for themselves, Dreyer said. The Winter Olympic Games will take place without foreign visitors or normal observers. China's zero-tolerance plan is meant to prevent the coronavirus from spreading within the country. Sport competitors, reporters, and officials are required to stay within special areas that keep them away from the Chinese public. About 106 of the 3,695 people who arrived from foreign countries tested positive for the virus. Two are competitors or team officials. Beijing officials have increased measures to prevent the spread of the virus in recent months. It ordered testing of 2 million people in one Beijing neighborhood after cases were reported there. Some families are not permitted to leave their homes. Foreign sports companies would like to make money in China. However, a ban on most foreigners has been a barrier to business development. Jeffrey Potter is president of Pro Skate Corner PTE Limited. The company works in China with the American hockey equipment maker True. He said the Olympics would have made sports goods more popular if not for the coronavirus. Not far from Beijing is a winter sports center called Vanke Shujinglong Ski Resort. Liu Yingkai leads marketing efforts to bring attention to the vacation center. Liu said visitors to the resort have risen by 15 to 20% a year since 2015, when Beijing and neighboring Zhangjiakou were chosen to hold this year's Winter Games. Liu added the numbers were up 40% last year, even with the pandemic. Li Sen is the director of the Beijing Olympic Organizing Committee's General Planning Department. Li said more than 450 ice rinks and 300 snow resorts have been built across China since 2015, although some have closed at times during the pandemic. Skiing and other winter sports have helped villages near resorts. For tourists to eat, there must be restaurants around, noted Jiang Xinwei. He works for Analysis International, a research company in Beijing. Long Shui Lian is a visitor at the Vanke Shujinglong Ski Resort. She said she fell in love with skiing her first time, although she fell a lot. More and more friends of mine know how to ski, Long told the Associated Press. Zhang Xiaodong grew up in Zhangjiakou, but never learned to ski. He is learning the sport as an adult. Zhang said, I have to learn how to ski, so when I bring my kid here next time, I'll know how to teach my kid. I'm Jill Robbins.
American scientists have announced another step toward producing energy from nuclear fusion. U.S. government researchers said they were able to cause a fusion reaction that sustained itself and produced energy for a very short period. The scientists said this was an important step because it is very difficult to get fusion to become self-sustaining. Fusion requires extremely high temperatures and pressures, and the process can easily stop. Fusion happens when the nuclei of two atoms are subjected to extreme heat. This leads to the formation of a new, larger atom and the release of energy. Fusion is the process that fuels stars, including the sun. Some experts have suggested that someday fusion energy could be used to provide limitless, pollution-free power. One barrier to that goal is the fact that the fusion process itself needs a lot of energy. Scientists have not yet performed a fusion reaction that releases more energy than it requires. Government scientists with the National Ignition Facility at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California carried out the experiments. The lab is part of the U.S. Department of Energy. The experiments took place in November 2020 and February 2021. Research results recently appeared in a study in the publication Nature Physics. The state reached in the experiments is called burning plasma. Plasma is one of the four main states of matter. It contains charged particles, including ions and electrons. The Department of Energy explains that burning plasma is one in which most of the plasma heating comes from fusion reactions. Alex Zylstra is an experimental physicist at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He helped lead the research. Zylstra told Reuters that the process is similar to trying to start a fire. If you want to make a campfire, you want to get the fire hot enough that the wood can keep itself burning, he said. This is a good analogy for a burning plasma, where the fusion is now starting to become self-sustaining. The experiments involved aiming 192 lasers at a small capsule held inside a gold metal container. The researchers reported the process heats the capsule to about 100 million degrees Celsius. This creates about 50% more pressure inside the capsule than what is inside the center of the sun. The experiments created burning plasmas that lasted just 1/1,000,000,000th of a second. But Zylstra said that was enough to be considered a success. He said fusion had produced about 10 times as much energy as went into heating the fuel, but it produced less than 10% of the total amount of laser energy because the process remains inefficient, Zylstra added. The amount of energy produced was far more than in past experiments, the researchers said. But it was still small, about the same amount that is contained in 9-volt batteries. Earlier experiments in the U.S. and Britain succeeded in fusing atoms but produced no self-heating, Stephen Cowley told the Associated Press. He directs the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory in New Jersey, but did not take part in the study. Zylstra said making fusion remains a huge and complex technological challenge. It will require serious investments and many years of study before it can be considered a realistic form of energy production. He added, I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The United States Constitution guarantees freedoms such as freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion. The Bill of Rights in the Constitution protects these and other individual rights. But the government has not always honored all of the rights in the Constitution. In the 1700s, for example, President John Adams supported laws to stop Thomas Jefferson and the Democratic Party from criticizing the government. During the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln took strong actions to prevent newspapers from printing military news. And during the 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy accused innocent people of being communists and traitors. Some of the most serious government attacks on personal rights took place in 1919 and 1920. A number of government officials took sometimes unlawful actions against labor leaders, foreigners, and others. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe discuss the campaign that came to be known as the Red Scare.
These actions took place because of American fears about the threat of communism. Those fears were tied closely to the growth of the organized labor movement during World War I. There were a number of strikes during the war. More and more often, workers were willing to risk their jobs and join together to try to improve working conditions. President Woodrow Wilson had long supported organized labor, and he tried to get workers and business owners to negotiate peacefully. But official support for organized labor ended when strikes closed factories that were important to the national war effort. President Wilson and his advisors felt workers should put the national interest before their private interest. They told workers to wait until after the war to demand more pay and better working conditions.
In general, American workers did wait. But when the war finally ended in 1918, American workers began to strike in large numbers for higher pay. As many as 2 million workers went on strike in 1919. There were strikes by house builders, meat cutters, and train operators. And there were strikes in the shipyards, the shoe factories, and the telephone companies. Most striking workers wanted the traditional goals of labor unions, more pay and shorter working hours. But a growing number of them also began to demand major changes in the economic system itself. They called for government control of certain private industries. Railroad workers, for example, wanted the national government to take permanent control of running the trains. Coal miners, too, demanded government control of their industry. And even in the conservative grain farming states, 200,000 farmers joined a group that called for major economic changes.
All these protests came as a shock to traditional Americans who considered their country to be the home of free business. They saw little need for labor unions, and they feared that the growing wave of strikes meant the United States faced the same revolution that had just taken place in Russia. After all, Lenin himself had warned that the Bolshevik Revolution would spread to workers in other countries. Several events in 1919 only increased this fear of violent revolution. A bomb exploded in the home of a senator from the southeastern state of Georgia, and someone even exploded a bomb in front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, the nation's chief law officer. However, the most frightening event was a strike by police in Boston, Massachusetts. The policemen demanded higher wages, but the police chief refused to negotiate with them. As a result, the policemen went on strike. When they did, thieves began to break into unprotected homes and shops. Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge finally had to call out state troops to protect the people. His action defeated the strike. Most of the policemen lost their jobs.
All this was too much for many Americans. They began to accuse labor unions and others of planning a revolution. And they launched a forceful campaign to protect the country from these suspected extremists. Leaders of this campaign accused thousands of people of being communists or Reds. The campaign became known as the Red Scare. Of course, most people were honestly afraid of revolution. They did not trust the many foreigners who were active in unions, and they were tired of change and social unrest after the bloody World War. A number of these Americans in different cities began to take violent actions against people and groups that they suspected of being communist extremists. In New York, a crowd of men in military uniforms attacked the office of a socialist newspaper. They beat the people working there and destroyed the equipment. In the western city of Centralia, Washington, four people were killed in a violent fight between union members and their opponents. Public feeling was against the labor unions and political leftists. Many people considered anyone with leftist views to be a revolutionary trying to overthrow democracy. Many state and local governments passed laws making it a crime to belong to organizations that supported revolution. 28 states passed laws making it a crime to wave red flags.
People also demanded action from the national government. President Wilson was sick and unable to see the situation clearly. He cared about little except his dream of the United States joining the new League of Nations. But Attorney General Palmer heard the calls for action. Palmer hoped to be elected president the next year. He decided to take strong actions to gain the attention of voters. One of Palmer's first actions as Attorney General was to prevent coal miners from going on strike. Next, he ordered a series of raids to arrest leftist leaders. A number of these arrested people were innocent of any crime, but officials kept many of them in jail without charges for weeks. Palmer expelled from the country a number of foreigners suspected of revolutionary activity. He told reporters that communists were criminals who planned to overthrow everything that was good in life.
Feelings of fear and suspicion extended to other parts of American life. Many persons and groups were accused of supporting communism. Such famous Americans as actor Charlie Chaplin, educator John Dewey, and law professor Felix Frankfurter were among those accused. The Red Scare caused many innocent people to be afraid to express their ideas. They feared they might be accused of being a communist. But as quickly as the Red Scare swept across the country, so too did it end in 1920. In just a few months, people began to lose trust in Attorney General Palmer. They became tired of his extreme actions. Republican leader Charles Evans Hughes and other leading Americans called for the Justice Department to obey the law in arresting and charging people.
By the summer of 1920, the Red Scare was over. Even a large bomb explosion in New York in September did not change the opinion of most Americans that the nation should return to free speech and the rule of law. The Red Scare did not last long, but it was an important event. It showed that many Americans, after World War I, were tired of social changes. They wanted peace and business growth. Of course, the traditional way for Americans to show their feelings is through elections. And this growing conservatism of the nation showed itself clearly in the presidential election of 1920.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.